Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Live special number 246, recorded April 13th, 2015. Broadcast Minds at NAB.
Try and keep the fans involved in the game.
There's so many different benefits. The possibilities are really endless.
La creatividad que se logra y las cosas que se pueden hacer de calidad.
We try to tell the best story we can, and that's all we're really worried about.
It's really important to us to find ways to convey the excitement of the unknown.
Audiences who can't actually make it here to the museum can follow the shows live online.
It creates a whole expansion of the size of that event just by allowing more people to see it simultaneously.
We have a different objective, and that is to engage local people. Community engagement is a really important part of what we do.
These guys, they want to show off to each other, they want to show what they've done. We needed to capture those moments. Instantaneously give them those moments so they can then immediately share them with their friends.
We're challenged to raise the bar. So I think we're really pushing the boundaries of what corporate television is and can be.
It was kind of cool to know that thousands of people are watching something that I'm creating right now.
You put a lot of hours, you put a lot of work into it. And, you know, whenever people give you that acknowledgement of job well done, you put on a good show, no better feeling than that.
How are you guys doing today? All right, I'm getting heckled already. We haven't even gotten started and the heckling has begun. My name's Philip Nelson with NewTek. I'm the Chief Relationship Officer, and I'm really excited to have you guys here today to join us for another Broadcast Minds panel. You know, the NewTek, I don't know if you guys know this little piece of propaganda, but NewTek's customers, a lot of you are sitting in this room, produce over 250,000 hours of video a month. And it is so exciting to work for a company that is changing the world. We do have an amazing panel today, and the concept of Broadcast Minds is to bring together big thinkers who are changing the definition of what it means to be a broadcaster. And every year, we have cool people come in, and we talk about big things and where it's going, and this year, we have some pretty studly panelists. I'm going to go ahead and jump right in and start with introducing our moderator, Mr. Leo Laporte. He's known as the godfather of tech broadcasting. He was a pioneer with tech TVs and the show The Screensaver. He's also the tech guy on a nationally syndicated radio show. And he has a very cool title. He is the chief twit at twit.tv. And they're producing over 40 hours of live content every week. Let's hear it for Mr. Leo Laporte. And I'm proud to announce his hair has grown back after his little stunt raising some money. So welcome, Leo.
Hi, Philip.
The best-dressed man in the room right now.
Bow ties are back, baby.
All right, so Leo's going to be moderating for us, so let's go ahead and get to introducing our panel. Mark Debevoise is the EVP and GM of Entertainment, News, and Sports for CBS Interactive, and he runs the digital arm for CBS, which is the number one television network in America. They are the largest premium content network on the internet. They have over 300 million unique monthlies. 140,000 of those are domestic, or 140 million are domestic. And they recently launched CBS All Access, which is a direct-to-viewer product, along with a 24/7 CBSN live news streaming. They're definitely stirring up the industry, Help me welcome Mark DeBevoise. All right, our next panelist. Once again, all these people are disruptive. And I was sitting in the green room backstage, and they're disruptive, so even backstage, right?
My, yeah.
All right, so our next panelist is Sterling Proffer, head of digital strategy for Vice.com. They are the largest media outlet for millennials. They started 20 years ago as a print organization. They moved to online, and in 2006, they added video. And now they're moving into television with a deal they just signed with HBO. As we said, we have these disruptive people. Help me welcome Sterling Proffer of Vice.com. All right, our final panelist for today is known as the Scobalizer. Robert Scoble, he's got a great title too. He's a futurist at Rackspace. He spends his life traveling the world and studying innovators. He's known to many, as I said, as the Scobalizer, and he has some pretty impressive social media statistics. 6.7 million Google Plus followers, 450,000 Twitter followers, 670,000 Facebook followers, and he's one of the first people to create video on the internet from within inside a company when he was with Microsoft. So help me welcome the Scobalizer, Robert Scoble. And he's carrying his Thor's hammer. But anyway, Leo, take it away.
All right. Hey, thank you, Philip. Thank you for being here, everybody. And thanks to our panelists. It's a great panel. And, you know, it's really fun for me to walk through NABE every year and see how broadcasting is changing. And I'm wondering maybe if you guys could characterize it from your point of view. What is happening in broadcasting? What are the big issues going on? Why don't you start, Mark? Since you come from a traditional broadcaster.
We've got guys walking around with, you know,
that's weird.
Six-headed cameras.
We should explain what that is.
Title that's, futurist.
That is six GoPros, and it's designed to do what?
Do 360 video for something like the Oculus Rift, but YouTube just turned on the ability to scroll around. So if I was recording this on stage right now, the viewer could decide who they're going to look at.
We could explain, too, that Robert just got back from Coachella. He's had 3 hours sleep.
I haven't even taken off my glasses yet.
And you can see the GoPro video at the GoPro booth, the video shot at Coachella.
They're processing it right now.
Okay. Yeah. So are they going to put it up, or are they just going to show it at the booth?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sure we're going to put some of it up. It might take me a week to edit it and stuff like that.
Is that part of what's changing broadcasting, Mark?
Maybe.
We don't know yet.
We were talking about it. It's not really consumer ready, I think, yet. It's coming. When everybody's wearing goggles instead of staring at us with their eyeballs, maybe we'll be there. But still needs a distribution mechanism. And actually, I think that's one of the big things that's changing in broadcast. It's really, great content is still great content. And when you can create it, you're going to be in great shape. I think that's true of a couple of us here on the panel. But I think what's really changing is how you distribute it and how you put it out and get it to consumers. And I think, I look at it as sort of three big trends that have shaped where we are. One is connectivity is now universal. You essentially have 80% of homes with a broadband connection that can deliver robust video in a very, clean and good way. You have device proliferation that's absolutely massive, right? Who doesn't have a smartphone? I have like 9 people filming me right here,
right.
Or they were filming him.
We're on Meerkat. Everybody, yeah. We got 80 Meerkats.
How many people know about what Meerkat is?
That's pretty good number. Good. Yeah.
Can we take a quick vote? Meerkat versus Periscope. Who's on Team Meerkat?
No one.
Who's on Team Periscope?
Ooh. Wow. The owners dominate. No, and I think the third piece is that now that connected device class is going to move sort of back to the TV. You now have, set-top boxes that can deliver IP signals that are really, clean and easy to get onto if you have the right technology. So you put those three things together, and you're really going to see an explosion of a new form of distribution that you haven't seen before. Yeah, web distribution's been growing. It's been massive. But I think you're really going to see that shift, continue. I think we're probably 3 years in. We didn't know we were 3 years into probably a big 10-year shift as it happens over the next, next 7 years.
It feels like it's starting to happen. You can start seeing the evidence of it. Sterling, you're a content guy. Do you care about distribution?
Of course. We like to own as much of it as we can. And then
what do you mean own it?
Well, just control it. Not
in the old days, that meant you had a television tower and a transmitter or a printing press.
Yeah.
You don't mean that.
Well, I mean, you can basically rent or lease. There are all these buzzwords that you can use for how you treat, how you get your content out into the world. But what you can definitely say for sure is that content owners now have a lot more control over how, when, and where it goes. And I think that presents a really incredible opportunity for people that can actually start to think about where and how that content is consumed while they're thinking about how they make it. I mean, if you just look at Robert here with his awesome rig, I mean, he's thinking about how and where people are going to watch this, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's on an Oculus device, whatever it may be. You know, it starts to really inform the creative process, right? In the world of 2D TV, you know, I mean, I went to film school and day one they teach you, right? The 180 TV. Rule, right?
Yeah.
They teach you the 180. Don't break that or else right. confuse the audience. I mean, when you can look in 360 degrees, it kind of introduces
what does it
a
even
whole
mean?
New art.
Yeah.
What does it all mean?
You can't cross the line in 3D video. 360
yeah.
video.
It's hard to shoot with this because there's no crew. You're always in the shot, right? So
there are many broadcasters who like that idea.
The movie magic of 3D video and 360 video.
It's not for
would you say Vice is an aggregator, though? Or what is
Well, I mean, we aggregate ourselves.
Yeah, you create the content.
We make 100% of what we distribute.
Interesting.
So, you know, for us, you know, discovering video and discovering content of any kind is tricky enough. And oftentimes you don't necessarily know who made the video and you don't know if it's just been aggregated into some place or where the original content came from. And for us, you know, we found that Vice has been consistently a breath of fresh air for our audience. They always know that they can come to us and what they see or wherever they see the Vice brand, whether it's on our website, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram, on any platform, social, OTT, TV, whatever, that there's going to actually be consistency in the voice and consistency in the content that they're going to be able to. And I actually just had someone say this again the other day, which is, you know, people have said that we're one of the few content companies where you don't need to see any graphics, you don't need to see any watermarks, anything, and you can still know that it's
you know
a Vice piece of content.
Yeah.
And that is really, really important for us. And as distribution becomes increasingly fragmented, exponentially fragmented, having consistency in that voice, you know, we think is really, really important.
Robert, you're the king of brand.
You're the king of voice.
Individual brand.
For me, well, in terms of the show, the thing for me is the drone war. 3D Robotics just announced a new drone where you can set a cable, a virtual cable, and have the drone fly down that cable. That's pretty cool. And DJI just announced a drone last week. So there's a lot of action in the drone, the aerial camera space. Coachella was using a drone, a DJI drone, over the audiences last night to shoot the concerts.
You sure you didn't just imagine that?
I was
it was
sober.
Glowing.
Last year I was not sober. This year I was sober. So 3D is 360 video is coming. Coachella was playing with a couple of video cameras there that do wraparound video for Oculus Rift and stuff like that. But this has no distribution yet. I mean, YouTube just started distributing it 2 weeks ago. Facebook announced support and is supposedly going to turn it on in September. So I think this story is going to be NAB next year. There's going to be a lot of cameras that are going to come out. From what I hear, there's a few camera companies that are working on 3D, 360 cameras for next year. And that'll be the show theme next year. But I think this year is drones, you know, if you're in the consumer space, in terms of, you know, 4K is starting to become real, I think, in terms of screen.
But Robert, you and I are technologists, so we're kind of fascinated by technology, maybe to an excess. It sounds like, you know, Sterling's saying content is king. Mark, you are part of your job is to bring content to new technologies. How much do you pay attention to technology? How much do you pay attention to content?
Well, I mean, I think of it as content is king, distribution's queen, and essentially technology should be the, I don't know, the servant in between. Maybe that's a bad way to say it, but the place that can get you from content to distribution, right?
Are you looking at different new technologies, thinking, how do we apply this to what we do?
Or? Absolutely. I mean, I think what impacts us more, camera technology will evolve to the point at which it can be used to shoot some of the content, and then therefore the creators can use it. But right. I certainly have creators at this point saying, I want to put a GoPro on my set, or I want to put a GoPro here. They refer to it as a GoPro, first of all, instead of as a camera.
That's like Kleenex. It's the brand.
It's like Q-tips.
Yeah.
I think we think about more technology like social media and how that changed how people discover and find our programming. The distribution of the new set-top boxes out there like Roku or how Chromecast works or Apple TV or any of the game consoles and how those enable us to take an internet signal to the television. You know, frankly, mobile over the last 5 years and the explosive growth that is. I mean, it's just absolutely phenomenal and where everything's... it's now surpassed desktop, if you count tablet and phone together in terms of consumption for us and frankly for everyone in the video space. So I think it's a means to an end, a type of distribution, but a very, essential and important part of how to get there.
How did it work at CBS? Did Les Moonves say, we got to be in this, let's go find somebody like Mark and figure out how to do it? Is that what happens?
I mean, I don't know how they I know how they found me, which is a guy named Xander Lurie, who now runs media over at GoPro, was the
oh, that's funny.
CFO at CNET and got acquired, and he and I used to be bankers together 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. So I'm a recovering investment banker. When we came together about 4 years ago, the new group that runs CBS Interactive, we started to look at what was going to evolve. And probably about 2.5 years ago, we started to say, we were growing and we had the division working pretty nicely. But we said, look, there's something that's going to change here pretty big. And we have a couple of big opportunities. One in news about how do we, we were delivering news 2.5 hours a day. Meanwhile, we were creating enough news to program a full channel.
Right.
And why weren't we exploiting that?
Right.
Well, now we have a new distribution mechanism, which was we could do that. And we could target it at younger audiences and use new anchors and do all kinds of things. So that's what the impetus for CBSN was, a great collaboration between our news division and Interactive to launch a new product there across probably 7 or 8 platforms on the first day. And then All Access was the other big innovation, which was our direct-to-consumer subscription product that also includes the live linear feed of your local television station, your local CBS station. And that was really sort of a 2-year process of thinking about where our competitors had gone with Hulu Plus, had sort of had their brands taken off it, but had gotten their content out there, and where we were in the TV Everywhere landscape, sort of not having the right deals in place with our distributors to really execute those rights. Meanwhile, knowing we could do it from a tech perspective. So we really talked about that, honestly, for a year, then started building it for about 9 months, and then finally launched it. So
there's a difference in speed between how fast tech moves and how fast you can move. And also, you don't want to probably move as fast as technology.
We have a great business. And
right. You have to be...
70 to 80% of television is watched live on a TV.
Is that true, really?
Yes,
wow.
Absolutely.
80%
on CBS, 70%, 70-something across the industry. And I think people fell asleep on live, when the first 10 years of sort of internet video were like on demand, search, you'll figure it out. You know what you want. Come on. And forgot the fact that like people like to be programmed to, they like to be aggregated to around a brand.
80%.
Yeah. And sports and news drive a lot of that, but it is essentially 70-80%.
That's a good example.
With DVRs in place.
That's a good example of how you can get ahead of the game by not understanding your audience. I would have assumed that most people are watching on demand now. That's amazing. That's very interesting. You did something interesting at Vice. First of all, I had no idea, and you were telling me Sterling Vice is started 21 years ago as a magazine. But the modern Vice really is targeted at millennials. It's targeted at younger people.
Yeah. Vice did start as a Gen X company. It was a bunch of 20-somethings in 1994 who were having fun making a magazine about sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Right.
And
hence the name.
Well, the name is actually a funny story. Originally, the company was the Voice of Montreal. And for reasons that we don't need to get into, they needed to change their name. And so they decided to drop the O and call it Vice.
Was that a good move or a bad move? Sometimes I think Vice sends a message, maybe it doesn't among millennials.
I mean,
you're stuck with it, I guess, now.
We're very happy with it. But, the company went online in 99, started a record label in 2001. We've always had our foothold, I guess, in youth culture. And when we went online, the audience aged down, obviously. And, you know, Vice has always been, you know, Vice is not a company where we make boardroom decisions about this is the direction that we're headed, and here's the gap in the market, and here's where we're going to go. It was really just a company that was built by its audience because the audience worked there.
You had the passion for it.
And we had the passion for it. And in 2006, we started making online video. And that's when the company really started to grow. And in 2009, we launched the first vertical or the first new channel in the Vice family, which is called Motherboard, which is focused on science and technology. And then we just continued to grow from there. We launched Noisy, our music channel. And then 2012, we went to YouTube and we started distributing our video there. And then, you know, we had all these moments where it was kind of each moment represented a new sort of birth for the company in terms of the size of the audience that we were able to reach. And really, you know, the story of Vice is the story of the evolution of technology, right? Like, it was, you know, the ability to put out a magazine that you could design on your computer, right? And then it was Final Cut. And then it was YouTube. And it was all these different technologies that actually allowed people who were not technologists to leverage it in a way that that people who were very much content people could figure out and use to get out to our audience.
Who's your competitor? Is it Snapchat or is it BuzzFeed?
I mean,
Coachella was publishing live Snapchats, you know, and had a team doing that, right?
Yeah, I mean, we love Snapchat. Snapchat is our friend. basically, you know, it's a funny question. If you break up the Vice business,
I bet half this audience hasn't even tried Snapchat.
Who has Snapchat installed on their phone?
Yeah.
A third. I mean, Vice actually has a partnership with Snapchat. They launched something called Discover, which is really nice because it's not an aggregation of everything.
Right.
It's a set of hand-selected partners that they worked with who are publishing to Snapchat in a way that really makes sense for the Snapchat audience.
When they launched that, it wasn't very long ago, I thought, this is really interesting because there's no way to monetize it. But then you watch Katie Couric. Oh, there is. There'll be ads in there? All right. That's coming.
It's there.
They're doing it now. Yeah. But you watch Katie Couric do a newscast, basically, by swiping from story to story. It made sense for a few things. For ESPN, it makes sense because you can have sports highlights. What's your Snapchat strategy, Mark?
We're talking to them. I mean, we think it's interesting. Our audiences aren't necessarily, you know, there's a lot of people on Snapchat, so I don't say our audiences aren't there, but we're trying to figure out what the right strategy for us is for each of our brands. I mean, I think for sports, it makes a lot of sense. For news, it makes a lot of sense.
It does. For the quick hit stuff.
For entertainment, it's a little less obvious, right, of how you, like, make, you know, NCIS work for Snapchat. I don't think it's going to. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
So we have to pick our spots and find the right areas. We certainly think Facebook and some of the sort of broader platforms
It sounds like you both are treating media the same way I am in the corporate world. I work for Rackspace, and we're on a lot of these platforms. We have a TriCaster and do professional video to YouTube and other places. And it sounds like the world is like that. Coachella was like that. They had professional 4K video cameras and crews shooting everything, you know, with a YouTube as a partner. Live streaming all weekend long, and then they had Snapchat channels going. So is that the new world where everybody in
I feel like everybody wants to go out there. I said this on a panel earlier today. It's like they want to go out and say, well, these things exist, and they're in the ad business, so they're going to live, and everything else is going to die, right, that exists in ad sales. And I'm like, guys, it's like, it's not that straight, you know. These guys are our partners, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Snapchat. They're all partners for people that create content and want to distribute it to new audiences who now have these technologies, these applications, and that's how they consume certain kinds of media, maybe shorter ones or different ones, and different ways they do it. You have to look at how you play in it. We're all hiring teams and people to figure it out, you know, for each type of content.
Sterling, what's your sense, though, of what Snapchat means to Vice? I mean,
it means what every gathering place for audience means. You know, I mean, it means that people find value in congregating in these places, whether it's an app or a social network or something where they're creating their own content or just consuming content. I mean, it really just comes down to what your goal is as a content creator. I don't even want to say as a media company. I mean, Rackspace is a media company in that respect. I mean, every brand is a media company because they're publishing.
And our customers, TED is a customer. That's a media company, really.
Of course. And so, you know, I think that if your goal is to have your content reach as many people as possible, then you should think about all the different places where you can reach your audience and then just make sure that you're doing so in a way that that is aware of and respectful of the sort of nuances of that community.
It has to be native to that medium.
It has to be native to it. I mean, because otherwise you get found out really quickly if you just
you look like a jerk.
Yeah, you look like a jerk. You look like an idiot.
Right. They don't get it.
And on the other hand, people like me who are playing around with consumer technology, I don't have a satellite truck, and I don't have a bunch of 4K cameras to do professional live broadcasting of a sport.
And neither do we, and we're a big media company. We don't have any of that.
What percentage of your audience watches live?
Well, it depends.
It ain't 80. I can almost be certain of that.
We, you know, I can't give you a stat on...
Do you have live content?
On occasion.
Okay.
And that's the thing. We have live... when live matters,
right?
And we program for live when live matters. I mean, when we were on the ground in Ferguson, for example, like we had incredible live coverage, and it really, I mean, you know, it was so amazing for us to see essentially what looked like a documentary, like come to life and be broadcast live, and, you know, just watching our hosts walk around and talking to police officers and getting a ride from the cops from one place to another and going out and seeing tear gas getting thrown out from the cops. Like, we were able to do so with a rig and with a staff that is an order of magnitude smaller and cheaper than, you know, any traditional broadcast operation.
You don't have to tell me and Robert that. We walk around with monopods.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just...
helmet cams.
It's pretty amazing because, I mean, I'll just give you a funny example. When we started Vice News a year ago, we came out of beta early because we were on the ground in Crimea. We were putting up dispatches daily from Ukraine, and we saw a bunch of comments online that said, you guys should also be in Venezuela. And we're like, okay, right. So we sent another crew to Venezuela, and, you know, 3G is so terrible there. And we were putting, I learned so much about, like, crazy cellular, you know, technology. And basically what happened is we were dealing with situations that were just so terrible. We had just launched such a bare-bones staff. Our global head of content, Alex Miller, was trying to live stream, and he was trying and trying and trying, and the signal kept cutting out. We ended up having to put together and hijack a rig where I ended up calling him on my cell phone, patching that audio from the eighth inch in my phone out into a computer, which I think we then screen capped that to pull the audio and push that out to a feed. But we were able to do live, you know, over the web in a situation where basically the government was trying to shut down any live broadcast. And the fact is we could do that because we had mobile technology and we had a really killer crew who could basically, you know, duct tape together the internet.
But this is something Edward R. Murrow may never have done. But is this something that, I want to ask Mark this, do you think audiences are more open now to kind of guerrilla coverage and rough and ready coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we launched CBSN, our view was we're going to launch a very professional looking product, but it's certainly going to be at fractions of the cost of what it would cost to run. I mean, the tweet that I always use is a guy, I've probably gotten this guy fired three times, so I won't use his name again, but he's a local producer for an NBC station who tweeted out that CBSN is what MSNBC should have been.
Wow.
And I like that because it's true. It's what we thought of as like where's headline news? Where's the guy that's just covering the news all day long and doing it live? And the reason live matters is for things like Ferguson or when the, you know, Charlie Hebdo happens or when those things happen, you're there, and you're there with staff that knows how to handle that. And that matters for people, and I think that's when people tune in. And what we see from the data, at least early, is that people are, first of all, watching live 2-to-1. And we literally make every asset that flows through CBSN comes into a DVR and pops into a VOD playlist right on the left-hand side of the screen. So you literally have full VOD access to the past hour instantly. And yet they're still watching the live 2-to-1, right? Because they're wanting, like, what is the news? Right. I don't need to pick my news. I want to know what the news is. And when you have a live event, we see, you know, 3, 4, 5x spikes. And so I mean, it wasn't a joke, but what we were saying is that the live is driven by what I would call mainstream, sort of serious news events that happen, and the VOD is essentially driven by pop culture, you know.
There's no urgency.
Bobby Christina got in the hospital, you know, or this or that, you know, something that is pop culture celebrity, you know, something around that nature that is driving the VOD views. But but the live stuff is driven by when a hard news story happens or a mainstream story happens. That's when you see those spikes.
I think it's so funny that this panel is called Broadcast Mind, because I think what you're really seeing is a complete deconstruction of what media is, of what broadcast is. It feels like technology is fragmenting it, is reinventing it. It's almost like bebop, where you're taking a chord and dividing it into a bunch of notes, and we don't know how it's going to fall. Does the audience accept this, is my question? Is this what they want? Or is this what we're doing because we can?
Well, you know, at Coachella, I saw a third of the people shooting this way and two-thirds of the people shooting this
because way. Because that's the right way.
For a mobile phone. But, everybody, you know, people in this room
makes,
think this
makes
is
people
hard.
So angry.
Hard, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to watch vertical video on my big 65.
But on your smartphone, you do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mostly because the new things are social. It's not all about the video. It's about all the people who are chatting with you. I was doing an interview with the geek who runs Coachella on Saturday on Meerkat, and there was 1,000 people watching, and they were asking really interesting questions, making my interview better, you know?
But so what do you do? I mean, in a deconstructed environment where, you know, it's almost as if we threw everything up in the air and we see what happens. You can't go too fast because, I mean, again, your audience is, you can't drag your audience into this.
I mean,
are they telling you what they want?
I'd throw two things out there. I mean, look, we're all experimenting and that's good. And we're trying to figure out what people want with new technology and new, you know, devices and connectivity and all those pieces. But my view is that brands are still going to matter. Brands that you can, you know, whether it's trust or aggregation of content you like or whatever, brands will matter. It's not just, everyone's like, oh, it's just about the show. Look, trust me, the show absolutely matters more than anything, or the content itself. But wrapping it in an aggregated brand that people understand and can come to, I think is going to be even more important as it fragments more.
That's interesting.
So I go with brand. And then I say, look, people don't change that much. I mean, it's funny, like, when are those peaks and valleys of news streaming? In the morning and in prime time.
Right.
When are the peaks and valleys? You know, it's like, it doesn't, people's days don't change that fundamentally just because technology changed. It's like, life is still life, you know?
Right.
You're still going around doing the same types of things.
Yeah, and people want to they just want to be informed, they want to be entertained, they want to have fun, and they just want that to just work in whatever mode of thinking they're in, right?
But for a generation that's grown up watching YouTube as their primary television, what, they don't care about brand, do they?
Oh, they care about brand even more. I mean, think about the rise of the vlogger. What is a vlog? I mean, I don't want to start saying things like personal brand on stage, but, you know, I mean...
as he looks at me.
You're the master. Don't piss him off. He's got a nasty social following. I mean, the fact is that, you know, people are just people, and if you are going to build a company around, well, you know what? People have voices, and voices that resonate, you know, build audiences. They pull them in, and when that voice, whether it's a person or a media company, is consistently delivering against some value to the audience, people say, I want more. And now, you know, the atomic choice, the a la carte nature of the social web allows you to identify and sort of self-select with who you want to follow and who you care about. And, you know, if you're someone like Robert, you know, Robert is going to be Robert on any single platform. And whether it's through text or whether it's through video or whether it's through 360 video, whatever it may be, it's always going to be him. And, you know, I'm speaking for you, of course.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter
Robert doesn't need an overarching brand. Robert is the brand.
Is the brand. Yeah. But if you're going to build a company around that and you're going to make a whole lot of content,
right?
Then it's really good if the wrapper, it's really good if the handle, it's really good if the brand actually means something. And so for Vice, you know, we've built a very successful media company because there's integrity in the brand. There's integrity in what you're going to find. Even if there is a constellation of different things that we're going to cover, from news to sports to music to fashion to food to whatever it may be, there is that consistency that makes the Vice brand meaningful and that makes it reliable and that makes it something that the user wants to follow regardless of what platform it's on.
So there's really, it's two different, we're overloading the word brand because there's an individual brand like Roberts and there's a larger corporate brand like Vice or CBS.
Well,
is the corporate...
I do the Rackspace videos too and I think like that. If I don't give enough value to my audience, they stop watching. And then what do I got? Nothing, right? I try to keep the kinds of buy Rackspace messages to a very, very minimum level and give the audience a lot of value for watching because if they don't come back and watch tomorrow, I'm worthless.
So the value of the corporate brand is monetization?
Well, it's relationships.
Is it curation?
It's relationships.
It's relationships. It's branding, right? If I interview the team that built Oculus Rift, my Rackspace's brand is associated with Oculus Rift all of a sudden. And right. People think that, Rackspace is keeping up.
We're seeing a lot of creators, though, going off on their own, having their individual name, their voice, turning their backs on the big YouTube networks, going out on their own. Is there, you know, is there, do they need?
I mean, just for this thing, there's, there's three video sites that you can distribute this video.
Right, YouTube's one of them. Yep.
B-Radio.
The problem, one. Nobody even knows about them.
Little
Star.
They know YouTube.
Little Star.
Right.
Facebook's
going to do
it. One. Facebook's coming in September. YouTube is out as of 2 weeks ago. So even this space is radically changing. And the space of of YouTube, it continues to shift a little bit here and there. So,
what is the brand CBS? What is that? What do you bring to the table that an individual creator should be interested in that?
Well, I mean,
besides capitalization,
right? I mean, we really don't play in the sort of make a show in your basement, put it on TV space. You know, we're spending billions of dollars on programming every year. From major sporting events to news to major entertainment programming.
Although I've had some of my pictures and video on CBS done in the basement on TV. If you have news, for instance, I had John Edwards on a plane with his mistress. I had the only pictures. And were on all the TV networks, and they weren't that sharp or that
well produced. News is a different beast, right, to some extent. but look, I mean, when you're in that business, then that's not really individual creators. I mean, there are creators and their creative powers, but they're also spending millions of dollars per episode to create very high-quality premium content. And I'd say that's different than the space that YouTube has created, which I think has been phenomenal, right, that they've created a space for individual creators to have a voice. Look, it's not like the aggregate time spent on YouTube is trumping all of other media. It's huge and growing like crazy, and I think it's an amazing, platform, but it's also not the only platform with which to have programming delivered, right? Yeah. Television still, YouTube's essentially a cable network.
You don't feel like you're fighting a losing battle?
I don't view them as it's not an enemy, one dies, one lives kind of thing.
Definitely not zero sum.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's not zero sum.
It feels like we are consuming more content than ever before. It feels like.
Don't you sit on the couch with your phone while you watch?
Absolutely.
House of Cards.
I'm consuming three streams.
Or Game of Thrones, or whatever.
The best example we have is sports, right? Where we've made majority of our sports programming available for free online while it's airing on television, where we get paid by cable operators and have all these other business models. And the reason we feel comfortable with that is, it's best screen available. If you have a 55-inch screen where the basketball game is on, you're going to go to the 55-inch screen. You're only going to go to the small screen if you happen to be not in your home able to watch it, or if there's some other value that screen is delivering. Yeah. So when we did the Super Bowl a few years ago, we gave you stats and social and six camera angles, and we got 3 million people to do that on top of the 100 million people that watched the game. Those 3 million people were also watching it on maybe a few thousand were not watching it on a big screen, but most of them were. And so there's a second screen element to that device, and there's also a first screen element to it. And you have to play sort of correctly in both. And sports just lends itself. You're going to go to the best screen you have available, almost by definition.
But how does the cable company feel about that?
They're not losing anything because they're actually getting the viewer to come through their system.
So they're okay with it.
Yeah, if we were no longer on their cable system and it was just on the phone, do you think that viewer would be like, "Oh, okay, I guess it's not on my TV today. I'll just watch
right.
it." No, they want
They the want it on the TV.
Yeah, so they're going to that's the differentiation.
Yeah. And you feel like the incumbents, like the affiliates and the cable companies, are kind of understanding that this is the new world we live in.
Yeah, in most things, yeah. I mean, we don't put the NFL content that way. We sort of have kept
the NFL won't do that, will they?
Yeah, well, they have it on mobile for a charge.
I have a deal with Verizon.
And with a lot of other content, we've come to an understanding that this is not cannibalizing live viewership. It's actually probably helping it, right? Yeah. It's either keeping people connected or keeping them connected and keeping the game on longer. Like, if it's a blowout, most people are tuning out. Oh, wait, if there's something more interesting about
the
players.
You don't think that HBO ran a risk with HBO Now going over the top?
I think premium's an interesting space. I mean, I used to be at Starz. We own Showtime at CBS. Premium is one of the most unique spaces where you have an opportunity to grow the business without the buy-through, right? Cable buy-through has been spend $90 to get HBO, not the $15 that it costs. It's the $70 or $80 buy-through you got to go through. In a new world, you don't have to do that buy-through. There's a lot more subs out there for those businesses.
They're putting together also, the cable companies are putting together skinnier bundles that also include HBO, right?
And they've had skinnier bundles for a very long time, right? I mean, Comcast has had a broadcast-only bundle for a long time. There's a lot of other folks. I mean, I'm not saying... I think there's value in the bundle. I think that, you know, I subscribe to a big bundle. I like having all that content. There's a lot of people that like that. It's just for those that have held back from subscribing to HBO, Showtime, Starz, you know, you look at the Netflix model and say that's a premium network. It just happens to be you don't have to buy through anything to get to it.
Right.
So
right.
I think that's a big opportunity for premium.
Yeah. Vice just did a deal with HBO to do nightly news.
Yeah. We're going to do
wild.
A daily news show.
Why?
Because
first of all, why did HBO do it? Because that's not their reputation. And why would Vice do it?
Well, HBO has, well, first of all.
I guess with John Oliver, they're starting to get that as.
Yeah. And, Richard Plepler, the CEO of HBO, said, you know, he said that we're not in the news business. We're in the Vice business.
So, that must have made you feel good.
Yeah, warm and fuzzies all over. I think that HBO has just been an absolutely incredible partner for us, and they
do they see this as a way to get younger people who are not watching TV watching HBO?
Well, what I will say is I definitely think that there is, you know, there is a real opportunity. There's a moment, and you know, I don't need to sort of say anything beyond painting the picture of. Jon Stewart is stepping down from The Daily Show.
Yep.
Colbert is headed over to CBS. John Oliver is now with HBO.
Yep.
So there's a real opportunity to engage young people in news again. I mean, the thing that has been consistent for us is, young people, millennials, are consuming more news than ever before. So they're more engaged with news and more engaged with the world around them. They just are less engaged with the news brands that they've had.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've what we found in not only just talking to them, but in conducting research is we just found that they didn't feel that they were having their voice represented, and they wanted transparency, and they wanted to feel like that someone was out there sort of, you know, telling the stories that they want heard in a way that actually resonates with them. And that's just what we've done, and that's what we've done consistently across any category. But our news content has consistently been the most successful content that we've made. And so as a result, we've just looked for ways to help that reach more and more people. And frankly, HBO has been an incredible partner and an incredible platform to help us tell those stories and to tell them without any of the restrictions that we'd normally see elsewhere.
How many of you watched Game of... Oh, you probably didn't watch Game of Thrones last night because you're all here, right?
Yes, we did.
You did? Did you watch it on the cable, HBO Go, or HBO Now? HBO Now? Did anybody watch HBO Now? One person in the back. I guess it's not a threat. How did it work on HBO Now? Was there stuttering? Was it flawless playback? Because that was one of the concerns, right? And they went to the MLB Network and...
Wait, I was down in Australia when the iPhone was launched, and I was hanging out with some Telstra executives, and they pulled out two iPads. One, they put up their server load, so they knew how hard their servers were being hit. And the other one, they pulled up Australian football and were watching live football on an iPad. And I think that's the new world. You know, we'll bring our own screens around and watch wherever we want. I was watching TED videos live streaming on my mobile phone, you know, while I was walking around San Francisco.
So that's really your job, Mark, is to say, how do we take an existing mainstream media brand and move it into the 21st century? Is that really what you see?
I should just rewrite my job description just like that. Perfect. Done.
Yeah. And it's a challenge.
Can I call myself a futurist?
It's interesting, though. Yes, you can. You're a futurist.
I love that.
It's interesting, though, that CBS did not go the Hulu route. Why was that?
Look, I mean, I wasn't at the company when they made that for that decision initially, but
turned out to be the right decision.
I absolutely would have. I would have hopefully advised the same thing at the time. I think it was a smart decision, and I think, you know, for a number of reasons, for CBS, number one television network, whatever it is, you know, 9 of the last 11 years or something like that, and you know,
they didn't need to.
And frankly, in a joint venture like that, you know, history will say that joint ventures don't always work out that great.
Yeah.
You know, why are you splitting it evenly when the ratings are not even?
Right.
You know, and frankly, I think Hulu is interesting because it's essentially taken the network brands off of the shows, and now the shows are branded Hulu. And so if they are never able to monetize the equity of Hulu in some interesting way, they've basically just given up their brands.
They've destroyed a lot of value.
Yeah, I don't know if it's destroyed the value of their brands overall, but it certainly isn't helping their brands be aggregators for the future. We view it as the CBS brand will still be an aggregator, you know, like it was 20 years ago, like it is today, like it will be tomorrow. And our goal is to have the experiences be on our platforms, or at least via our brand,
right,
as much as possible. It cannot be 100%. You do have to syndicate and distribute. But we really do want to keep the brand paramount in people's minds.
So if Apple TV at some point comes along and starts, you'd put a CBS app on Apple TV happily. You'd put a Vice app on Apple TV happily.
We already have a CBS app on iOS and Android.
Right.
We have a CBSN news channel on Apple TV.
Is that important to have your brand, that eye on the screen there?
Absolutely.
Same for Vice?
Yeah. You know, I think that the way that we see it is it's very, very, very important to have your own, you know, a Vice-branded experience across all these platforms. That said, you know, we don't necessarily think that that should be the only place the Vice content should be available and consumed. The Vice-branded ecosystem, our websites, apps, OTT, whatever it may be, definitely need to be I like to call it like the safest place to consume Vice, meaning it should feel that everything that you want from us is there, it's nicely organized, it's available, it's personalized, it's everything that you'd ever expect to find from us. In addition to that, there's absolutely nothing that says that, you know, that we wouldn't want audiences to be able to go to different places when they're in different moods and different sort of states and different times in their life and different mental states to say, oh, well, if I go over to YouTube, I want to be able to serendipitously discover Vice content and get lost for an hour,
right?
To be able to go into these different aggregated experiences. But as long as they know that, you know, that they don't have to feel kind of lost in the wilderness and kind of searching around for like, well, where is this one thing that I was looking for? If there's always that Vice owned and operated experience that they can come back to, then I think that we can play in a pretty broad distribution ecosystem.
You gonna do a Scobalizer app?
You know, Facebook set. For me, you're gonna find me on Facebook.
Yeah, but you're on somebody else's platform.
Yeah, that's where I can play in a way that the media companies can't, because they have to monetize in a different way.
And you're nimble enough that if Facebook pulled,
I want to be a virus on the internet. I want you to see my content where you are, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to force you to come out of Facebook or out of Twitter or out of Google Plus to go visit my thing somewhere else. I want to be where you're at already. If Snapchat's where everybody ends up, I'll be there.
You'll
too.
Be there. Yeah. Yeah. We got a couple minutes. We're going to let people ask questions. So I want to give you guys a chance to say something if I haven't asked the right questions. Mark, is there anything you want to talk about? Or I don't want to leave you out. We love Newtek's TriCaster.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, yeah, definitely.
Tim Jennison's going. We all use it, right?
Phil's clapping on it.
Yeah.
We all use it, right? In our different spheres.
It's been absolutely amazing for us. Again, like I said this before, I didn't call it out by name, but what we're using with Talk Show is like absolutely amazing, just because we can, again, like skeleton crew, right?
Exactly.
We're producing weekly live shows that we're broadcasting, you know, across multiple platforms that we can do with four people and, you know, equipment in the tens of thousands of dollars as opposed to the tens of millions.
Yeah,
so it's pretty nice.
Yeah, my studio at Rackspace is three cameras. It's all run by one guy, Rocky, who helps me, and I'm on air. So thank you, Newtek. I mean, that was that kind of video for corporations wasn't really possible a decade ago.
It's really amazing what digital, the low cost, the rapidly dropping cost of digital technology, the distribution channel the internet provides, just reinvents everything that we do.
And what's interesting is to watch a mainstream brand like CBS grapple with it and find a way that works. Watch a new brand dominate by creating something completely unique. And then there's Scobalizer.
Well, I want a new tech for this. So in 3 years, 4 years, we're going to come back and, you know, my new tech will be able to switch from 360.
I really like the idea of immersing the audience. I don't like the idea of wearing a headset at all, but I love the idea of the audience being able to sit in this panel and sit right here and look around.
Or sit here, something like that.
I think that's very interesting.
And think about the future of sports.
Up a little
sitting
too
for sports. You know, it's always frustrating because the camera follows the quarterback. Maybe you want to look at the free safety, and this way you could do it.
The number one secondary stream when we did the Super Bowl a few years ago was the all-22 camera angle, which is coach's angle from above for people that want to watch
angle.
The whole thing, right? You know,
I've always wanted to. So there's two groups. There's one that wants you to switch for them. They watch live. They want you to take care of it. But there is a group of people who say, no, I want to switch the cameras. Yeah. I want control.
There's a camera company in Silicon Valley called Jaunt, which has 16 cameras, and they have one that they're working on that has 32 cameras, and the quality of their product is really awesome. This is pretty good. I mean, when you see a GoPro camera, it's pretty good, but that thing is just stunning.
I did the Jaunt demo. They had this boxing video I was telling you earlier, and it's like you're in the crowd, and I still went like this.
Yeah.
I'm not even in the boxing. Yeah. You know, you're not even in the
ring. When you try VR porn, it's amazing. All right.
Well, you're in the right town.
I don't know. I've been told. There are microphones somewhere.
I got a friend.
There's a microphone there.
So if anybody has a question there for this great panel, something you'd like to know, step up to the microphone and go ahead and ask the question. Or are you the type that just wants to sit there and let us package it for you?
Yeah, are you the
we can talk about drones while
80% live. That's actually amazing.
There's a question.
All right,
ladies first.
All right, ladies first.
So if you... I'm just an independent, all by myself, thinking about starting something. So do you have any advice for me?
Do it.
Yeah. I started at Microsoft with a $200 camcorder, and I got to 4 million users a month, and which proves you can, if you have access to something that people are interested in, even if it's crappy quality, people will watch it.
You know what makes it good quality is passion. Your passion for the subject, your enthusiasm for the subject. If you can communicate that, people will overlook a lot of other stuff.
That and find a niche that these guys, that all of us have right. ignored. You know, maybe
there's plenty of those.
Well, there's plenty of them, but find one that you can own and become known as the person of quilting or whatever it is, and you'll build a small audience. You know, if there's 10,000 people around the world that are into that, they'll start finding you because of the internet.
Show that you care. I think that that's most important, because if you don't care, it comes through very, very easily.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, you know, the internet and the media landscape is big enough for companies of all sizes. It's not zero sum. So just do something that's great, whether it's low quality, high quality, whatever it is. I mean, again, that's what we believe to the core, which is, like, if you're not telling an interesting story, people have plenty of other options. So make it interesting and you know, give a shit.
Even today I went to the GoPro booth and we went, you know, they're better at stitching than I am. So I learned like four or five things just standing in the booth and talking to people. And another guy came up who was also playing with it. He told me some other tricks and said, oh, have you checked this, setting in color software that I'm using to stitch this stuff? It's like, wow, it takes time. You know, you don't become a CBS overnight. You have to start in your garage.
And you may never become a CBS, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two payoffs to this. There perhaps is a living, but I think the big payoff for me, and I bet for you too, is the engagement of the audience, the interaction with the audience.
It's fun to be creative, right?
Yeah, and the creativity you get to express.
You know, share it with five friends. If you had five people watching you on Meerkat, that's a lot of fun.
Meerkat's a great opportunity for
somebody. Periscope, you know, you guys are in the Periscope, you know?
Yes, sir.
I'm still trying to figure out which one I'm going to use.
Okay, my name is Pablo. I come from Argentina. By the way, our 3G is worse than Venezuela. But okay, we keep working. Talking about just Meerkat and Periscope, since you're a futurist, and both you too, how do you think big companies can use Meerkat and Periscope in journalism? And also, how can they use those tools when user uses it. So how can big companies can get to use the users on Meerkat and Periscope?
I would just caution brands against being too pushy. Sit back and sort of participate in this new community. I mean, I already have 15,000 followers on Periscope, right? And I'm just watching a lot of video. I just did my first one a couple of days ago. I was sitting back and watching rather than being pushy about it, because I don't know what the right thing is there. And I was watching what worked and what didn't, and I was taking notes. So that was really interesting. So I'm going to maybe use that in the future.
I saw Prep Kitchen on Periscope, yeah, which was amazing.
See, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's just to sit in the back, in a
watch.
Prep Kitchen, and someone brought out a big hunk of lamb, and they were like, I mean, it was. It's so nice just to see what happens when you let people run wild. I think that Periscope, Meerkat, either or, are going to become increasingly important as news events happen, and as people are then able to bring out their camera and broadcast to the world, and as the distribution around, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of live streams simultaneously. I mean, I think that's going to be really, really important. And then I think that, you know, there's going to be a role for the amateur. There's going to be a role for the pro-am. There's going to be a role for the professional media company. And, you know, I think that people are just going to bring different value to the platform. And it may be because of their brilliance and their mastery of media. It may be because of their complete ignorance that they're going to actually stumble on something brilliant. So I think that, again, my refrain would just be that it's big enough for all of us. And so just try and do something interesting.
The advantage of doing something in the early days of a new platform is you can play around and nobody will whack you too hard. Yeah. If in 3 years you come and start playing around and doing crappy content in Meerkat, people are going to slap you around, particularly if you're a brand, right? Because you should know better at that point. Right now, everybody's just playing around, having a little fun, and I find that refreshing. Right.
I think it's interesting also from the social curation aspect, right, where you have editors and you have editorial people who are like picking, well, let's do more of this or less of this, but they're doing it based on, used to be gut, then it was like ratings one day to the next, now it's like hourly views. Pretty soon, now you're talking about instant. Like, you know, is that good or is that bad?
How many hearts am I getting?
Oh, yeah.
Move over. Go to
and
the
you
next.
See it instantly, right? If you really bring your audience in and show them something interesting, you get tons of hearts on Periscope.
I think I've been trying to figure out what made Meerkat and Periscope so different. Yeah. I think it's that. It's that instantaneous feedback, which incidentally feeds the innate narcissism of these kinds of medias, because you're like,
narcissistic feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
You might say it's narcissistic, but when I was doing it on Saturday, I was getting really interesting questions.
I think exactly right. You know, we've been doing, you were the moderator of my chat room 20 years ago. We've been doing live chat with our live streaming for 20 years.
You were on KGO Radio on Saturday mornings.
And right? I've known for 20 years how amazing it is to have an instant feedback loop with your audience. Yeah. It's incredible. It's something.
And just the power to democratize that experience,
exactly.
Right? And I think that you can democratize that experience on any level, right? So Meerkat and Periscope are democratizing that from a mobile standpoint, you know, again, to give credit where credit is due to our hosts here at NewTek. I mean, they're absolutely democratizing that for a class of people who may actually use Meerkat and Periscope as a way to discover that they've fallen in love with this and they want to know what they can do next, right? They want to know how they can build the next, you know.
And that's the when you talk to the investors in Meerkat, I know Josh Ellman who invested. That's what I want now. I want a better way to discover or share really cool channels with my audience, because right now I can't find the good content. There is some good content out there.
It's hard,
right? Because you have to flip through 50 channels to find the one that's sort of interesting right now, right?
And by the way, it might be a fad and be gone in 6 months, and so what? There's no cost to entry. It may or may not, but that doesn't matter. That's not really something you need to worry about.
No,
this is real. This is the real deal.
Deeper than a fad, yeah.
Next question.
Hi. Yes, so I live and work in Nigeria, in Africa, and hop around different African countries. And I was kind of interested in your insights or opinions on how content trends there are kind of catching up. So yes, we're not as developed in many ways, but we're catching up pretty quickly. So this might not be relevant for like CBS because, you know, you don't play in, but you should. But anyway, I was interested to see what your insights or opinions may be on how our content trends are kind of catching up and how they can plug into some of the stuff that's going on here.
I don't have a good answer other than I have lots of viewers on YouTube and Facebook.
Think about this. I mean, there is an advantage to countries that didn't have infrastructure,
cell
and phone infrastructure. They could leapfrog the existing incumbents. So there's an opportunity. I mean, you've got to get bandwidth, right?
Yeah,
and you've got to get devices. But once you get to that point, it's a green field, and the opportunities there are huge.
Nigeria is one of the largest English-speaking countries in the world. So the power to distribute content to, you know, these audiences that want content, it's really just a function of the distribution of the connectivity. So I think video is going to be really interesting. It all depends on the infrastructure investments. I talked to a friend who's now at the Berkman Center at Harvard studying the future of media in India, which is encountering some similar challenges. And they actually have a real challenge, one around media and connectivity. But additionally, India also has a major challenge around literacy. And so what you're actually finding is because of the connectivity and literacy issues, that comics are actually a really interesting way to communicate visually and to be able to share information across, you know, low bandwidth networks to an illiterate community. So I think that, you know, it's the responsibility of media companies everywhere to think about global audiences because they are global, and to really take the time to invest in understanding those local markets, to understand how we can actually make sure that we're delivering the right kind of value to those audiences.
By the way, Facebook and Google are putting drones or balloons up over your head. One of my friends...
Astro Teller's project.
Yeah, one of my friends said that in 3 years or 4 years, we're going to have global Wi-Fi around the globe, and that'll be a very interesting shift in distribution for all of us.
Well, and I think we all think about it now that we have the capability to go direct to that consumer wherever they are, that does strike a different opportunity than the opportunities of the past 30 years where you've had to go through a local distributor who held the keys to which 10 things got bought and which 40 things didn't. Now I think you have the opportunity to go reach that audience. And so I think for certain areas, even for us, it's like, well, certainly going to have that conversation around the news product, right? You know, maybe we won't, our rights are a little bit more encumbered on the sports and entertainment stuff, but areas where we are creating the content 100%, we have a lot of opportunity, you know, to look at that. So I think it's going to be an interesting, you know, sort of 5 to 7 years on that front.
We're out of time, but you've been standing there for a while, so let's get one more question and then we'll wrap it up.
So this question's directed at Vice, but I think applies to traditional media outlets because they're experimenting in this area. But what are the lines that are blurring between journalism and documentary filmmaking, and what are the implications, challenges, and opportunities that exist there?
That's an awesome question. We should probably talk about it after because I want to talk for too long about it. But, you know, it's...
You guys are doing films, right?
We're doing films. I mean, we take a documentary approach. We take a very immersive, first-person sort of empirical storytelling approach to the way that we do news. We didn't call it news when we started. We called it storytelling because what are we doing? We're telling stories about the world around us. And we just really thought that a lot of things were interesting. So we put people on planes and sent them there and pointed our cameras and hit record. So, you know, I think that you get more rigorous and you get more disciplined and you get more thorough as you mature. But really, you know, we very publicly went to video production school back in 2006, 2007. And, look at where we are today. So I think it's a very iterative approach. And as long as you are, and this is true for, you know, I mean, again, the leanest organization is the organization of one, hopefully. And then you kind of just have to...
Or two.
Yeah. And then you just have to sort of find ways to push that forward. And then if you look at what Mark's doing, I mean, Mark is moving continents. You know what I mean? What he's doing with CBS. So it's just taking that discipline. It's never being satisfied with what you have. And it's always knowing that you can be better. And having people like Robert here running circles around you and showing you that you have to be.
Yeah, come over to the GoPro booth and watch some of this video, you know, and you get inspired for the future, right?
If there's any lesson, it's that we're in a democracy, a brave new world. We're all starting over, and the opportunity is there for you guys. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience, and thanks to our panelists. Great job, everybody. Philip?
Let's hear it for Leo, Mark, Sterling, Robert Scoble. And also, I'd like to give a good shout-out to Skype and Media for help sponsoring this event for us. And we'd like to to thank the audience that watched online. And we hope to see you again next year. And speaking of, what'd you say, narcissism? What'd you call it?
Yeah.
Blatant narcissism or something?
I
think we should do a selfie from the stage. And everyone stands up and be in the background. So that'll be it. And come on, guys.
All right.
The Oscars has theirs.
Are you Ellen?
I'm Ellen.